Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep, and when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience, because Purple mattresses are made with a GelFlex grid. The GelFlex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips, and support in others, like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the GelFlex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines GelFlex grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off. It's better
over here. Now at T-Mobile, get four 5G phones on us and four lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on a required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge. Just to name a few, but if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's join, M-I-D-I.
After literally years of debate and discussion, last year, Illinois eliminated cash bail as a way of determining who stays behind bars while awaiting trial and who doesn't. Opponents of the move predicted dire and dangerous consequences. So how's it going? This weekend, you'll find out. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. Recently, a stellar panel took stock of the Pretrial Fairness Act and how Illinois' legal system is handling its provisions. The online event was part of the Civil Disagreement series sponsored by the American Bar Association, the Chicago chapters of the American Constitution Society and the Federalist Society, and the group Reform for Illinois. The three-member panel and the moderator looked at how the law was created, how it is being applied, and what may need to be changed in the law or the legal system. This weekend, we'll hear some excerpts. But first, I want to offer words of praise for the moderator of the panel, Professor Raph Donaldson. You won't hear his voice, but the faculty member of the Chicago Kent College of Law expertly guided the discussion. The panel included Joe Tabor with the Illinois Policy Institute, Cook County Public Defender Sharon Mitchell, and Insha Rahman with the Vera Institute of Justice. Each panelist was allowed 5 minutes or so to give their assessment of the Pretrial Fairness Act. The first panelist didn't take that long, but he played a vital role in the discussion. Joe Tabor could be considered the most conservative member of the group.
First, I'd like to thank the American Bar Association, the American Constitution Society, the Federalist Society, and Reform for Illinois for hosting this discussion. And thank you to Tiffany for running the behind the scenes, to Raph for moderating, and to my co-panelists, Insha and Sharon, who have actual hands-on experience in this criminal justice space. My name is Joe Tabor, and I'm the Director of Policy Director of Policy Research for the Illinois Policy Institute. We are primarily a free market think tank, but we also have done research in the realm of public safety and criminal justice reform. We've helped pass laws creating a path for people who have served time to obtain licenses as healthcare workers. And we are working on legislation to make it easier for those on electronic monitoring to find employment. As was said, in September, Illinois became the first state to completely eliminate cash bail statewide. And I think there are three things that we should keep in mind when we discuss that historic first. The first is that crime is a top priority for voters, especially in Chicago, and for good reason. 58% of Chicagoans put crime as their number one or number two concern. And violent crime spiked 11% in the past year. Theft, robbery, assault, battery are all up since then. Carjackings and vehicle thefts have doubled from the pre-pandemic levels. And a lot of people want to lay that partially at the feet of the bail reform, the getting rid of cash bail. And I think part of the reason for that is that the process of passing the legislation was lacked a lot of transparency, and it was rushed through. There were things that needed to be changed in the law, and it just seems that there's a fog of confusion around what the law actually says among the public. And number three is that these problems cannot be laid at the hands of bail reform. Bail reform is intended for a different purpose. It's not intended. It's not supposed to be used to detain dangerous criminals, even though that's what we had begun to rely upon on it. It's not a good way to do that. Cash bail tends to punish people who don't have money and release people who can pay the fee. But even so, the details matter, and there's things that we could have done better in this version of the law.
Sharon Mitchell spoke next.
My name is Sharon Mitchell Jr. I work at the head of the Law Office of the Cook County Public Defender. The Law Office of the Cook County Public Defender represents the vast majority of people here in Cook County, which is Chicago and many of its suburbs. When somebody cannot afford an attorney on their own, they are appointed an attorney from our office. And because the vast majority of people in the criminal legal system are poor, that means, unfortunately, that we represent the vast majority of people. So that is kind of our engagement with the process. I had some pre-prepared remarks, but the spirit has hit me to tell a story. I've been at the public defender's office a couple of times. This is my second instance with the public defender's office. Between stays, I worked in policy, and I worked to help support some of the changes to the pretrial system. And during that time, I was kind of going to a lot of radio stations or news outlets and kind of talking about what these changes could potentially make. And shortly after the signing of the law in 2021, I think it was in March or April, I returned to a radio show. And it was one of these formats where they had one conservative and they had one a liberal, and they would kind of debate on the issues, right? And as soon as I got on the show, one of the members basically said, "Well, Sharon, you came on here and talked about in the cash bond, and you finally got what you wanted. And look what happened. There's all this crime that has happened because of the in the cash bond." We were talking at that time in March or April of 2021. What the host did not know is that the actual changes would not be scheduled to happen for 2 years, right? So they were commenting on kind of the increase in crime supported by the end of cash bond about 18 months too soon. And the reality of the situation is that's what's happened a lot, right? There's this idea that that bond reform or bail reform is kind of this pro-criminal reform, and that there will be increases in crime just by its existence. And the actual facts and the realities don't really play into what is devolved into kind of a political discussion. I think Joe's right, though, that the details do matter. And the reality of the situation, if we take a step back, shortly before the passage of this bill, there was a well-funded and well-organized and really well-targeted campaign that described and tried to describe the changes around the Pretrial Fairness Act. It was described as the purge. It was described by really, unfortunately, serious people with serious jobs that the streets would run red with blood. Folks characterized the change as a deterioration of the criminal legal system. Well, we are now about 6 months into the actual implementation, about 8 months into the actual implementation. I just want to congratulate everybody on surviving the purge, right? The reality is that the changes in the Pretrial Fairness Act were common sense reforms. We can get deeper into what those reforms were, but the idea that we use money as a determining factor and whether somebody should be in jail pretrial or before any trial has happened was always a broken model. And whether you came from more of a law enforcement pro law and order space, or a more reformist or abolitionist, or there are too many people in jail space, everybody agreed that the system that we had before made no sense. So I'm really glad that we have moved into a system where judges are making these decisions based upon risk and not money. With that said, the Pretrial Fairness Act did not produce any crystal balls, right? It did not for judges. It did not it didn't abolish the presumption of innocence, right? So there are going to be people, right, who are accused of an offense and then reaccused of another offense, right? Those stories definitely exist. And we know that there are members or media forums that are dedicated to telling the story of every failure. But the reality is, right, the vast majority of people who are accused of a crime come back to court, right? Whether they are given a cash bond or not. And we know that oftentimes when we're discussing these issues, we rarely talk about the impacts on communities that the cash bond system presented. As a young public defender, one of the hardest things I ever had to do, or to do constantly, is talk with people from my community, mainly mothers, grandmothers, partners, sisters, women, about whether they would pay their loved one's bond or whether they would do the basic things they needed to do to survive, paying rent, things of that nature. The fact that we've eradicated this system, which served as a really one of the worst regressive taxes on Black and Brown women, is quite frankly one of the best reforms that we could have taken on. And as we continue to move forward, there are changes that could be made. There'll be debates forever. But the reality of the situation is that the system before the Pretrial Fairness Act was incredibly broken, and we're seeing significant benefits both in terms of public safety and fairness. So I'm really excited to have this conversation. Thank you so much to Joe. Thank you so much to Insha. And thank you so much to all the great folks that have put this debate together. And one thing I can say before I conclude is that I'm so glad that we have an opportunity to talk about the details and talk about what's really happening in this reform and push back past the politics of this issue and really talk about what it means to keep our community safe and make sure that our people who are accused of offenses have their constitutional rights looked after. So thank you so much, and looking forward to the conversation.
Finally, we heard from the Vera Institute's Insha Rahman.
Thank you for the grace of getting to go last so I get to listen to these brilliant folks and build upon their thoughts. So I got my start in working on this issue as a young public defender as well. And as Sharon said, it is both devastating to have the conversation with a mother or a sister or a girlfriend or a wife, like, how am I gonna pay my rent? Or do I pay bail? Knowing that not paying bail is the biggest consequence for the end of that case and also for that person's life. And then there's the other piece of it, which take out the sort of personal human impact, which is incredibly important, and go to the system itself. Every time I watched a judge set $250 bail or $500 bail, I always ask myself this question of, is the judge intending for this person to get out because they think that they can make $250 or $500? As a public defender in the Bronx, it's one of the poorest counties in the country. People don't have $25, let alone $250 or $500. Or does the judge intend to keep my client in jail, in which case there should be far more due process than just setting a money bail amount, before we take away somebody's liberty. So the problem with cash bail is, from perspective of the system, is that it obscures the real decision about whether somebody should rightfully be out or be in pending trial. So I did that work for a long time and then came to the Vera Institute of Justice, which is where I am now, in 2015. And I'm based in our New York office, and I work nationally on issues of bail reform. I'm the vice president of advocacy and partnerships at the organization and have worked on bail for the better part of a decade doing policy work. And I worked on New York bail reform. And doesn't matter where you are in this country, if you've never stepped foot in New York, you have an opinion about New York bail reform because you've heard things. And chances are what you heard is not flattering. And let me tell you this, 4 years after New York bail reform has gone into effect, as a matter of policy, it's working. It's doing exactly what bail reform is intended to do, which is to take money out of the equation, especially for low-level offenses where people should just be going home. There's no actual threat to public safety. And it's making sure that when bail is in fact set, because New York bail reform retained bail, it didn't really change the system for the more serious cases, the cases in which there are concerns about public safety, according to the allegations. What it did require judges to do is really consider ability to pay, and therefore that obscured decision of, like, is that money intended to keep the person in or allow them to be released? We actually get to look at that decision honestly. So it's not a perfect bail reform, in my opinion, as somebody who worked on it, but it is a bail reform that is working in that public safety has not been affected in New York. There are multiple credible studies from multiple different universities and researchers who have looked at the rise in crime in New York in 2021, 2022, it's coming back down, 2023 and into 2024, that rise in crime was not due to bail reform. They both happened to happen at the same time, but they are not correlated, let alone have any causation effect. And the other thing that we've seen is that bail reform has been good for justice, in that there are far fewer people behind bars in New York today as a result of that reform. And the reason I start with talking about New York bail reform is because it was, I would say, the first to go and sort of experience the real political backlash that we know Illinois experienced after in 2022 during the midterm election cycle, the purge. I can put a hard number on it, which was in Illinois. Before the law had ever gone into effect, the opposition spent $40 million fear-mongering about the law. And yet what happened in Illinois that I think is remarkable as a matter of politics that didn't happen in New York, because the minute the backlash to New York bail reform started in 2020, the same legislators who enacted the law, who passed it, who celebrated it a year before, ran for the hills and said, uh-oh, actually, we didn't mean to go that far. And they actually rolled back parts of the law literally within 4 months of it going into effect. And then we've been in rollback after rollback for 4 years. This is the first legislative session where there are no rollbacks to bail reform, so it is possible to get out of the bad politics, but you got to stay in there. It takes 4 to 5 years is what we're learning. In Illinois in 2022, when the political backlash started, we watched all those same legislators, everybody from Governor Pritzker on down to state legislators, actually hold firm. Maybe there were conversations behind closed doors, which were, uh-oh, what did we do? But publicly, it was support for the Pretrial Fairness Act and a reminder of why money bail is not just, it is not fair, and it is not a good system. And Pretrial Fairness Act went into effect in 2023, as we know, but at the end of 2022, during the midterm cycle, there was actually a poll that came out in late November, which asked Illinois voters, when it comes to bail reform, are you favorable, neutral, or unfavorable towards the law? 60% of Illinois voters said, even after $40 million worth of fear-mongering about the law, that we remain neutral or favorable towards the law. And it's because the politics held up around the law, supported the reforms, reminded people why we needed reform in the first place. And it's a really important lesson, I think, coming out of Illinois. And I know that we're a bunch of lawyers on this call, but I think we can't think only about policy or implementation or practice. We have to think about politics. We live in a world where politics is a very real thing. It's really important to think about the politics of these reforms and of implementation. And Illinois, from where I sit, is a great example of getting it right. I know there's a lot more work to be done. We're going to get into the details here. But I think that national perspective, and especially putting it in contrast with another law that has actually done what it's supposed to do, it doesn't feel that way, think it's really important for Illinois to have started off on the right foot as a matter of politics, and from what I can see is continuing to actually hold the politics around the law even as it goes into implementation. It will not be perfect, but we can see positive momentum, public support remains, and that is, I think, a really good thing for not only Illinois, but for other states to look to.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Delamore, and we're hearing excerpts from a symposium on how Illinois' justice system is faring now that cash bail has essentially been eliminated. The event was put on by the American Bar Association, the Chicago chapters of the American Constitution Society and the Federalist Society, and the group Reform for Illinois. As you heard, all of the panelists agree it's a positive step to move away from letting the ability to pay be what determines whether a person stays behind bars while awaiting trial or not. But they were asked about the challenges the law presents. Insha Rahman went first.
Where we've seen bail reform statewide work is where there's been significant investment and building up of community-based pretrial services. And that has started to happen in some parts of Illinois, but it is pretty checkered, and there hasn't been, I would say, nearly enough money, nearly enough investment, and nearly enough sort of standardization of how pretrial services happens, so that judges actually have a choice in the cases where they have discretion about, do I release this person or do I detain them pending trial? Do I have another option? And I would say in the law itself, there are some good safeguards around when supervision can be imposed and when it shouldn't be, some safeguards around sort of not having permanent or endless supervision during the pretrial period. But in order for any of that to be a reality and to take hold, you've got to do pretrial services well.
Sharon Mitchell, the public defender, felt a little background was in order here.
This law was signed into place in January of 2021. There were about 2 years and 8 months between the time that it was signed into law and the time it actually went into effect. So, you know, some of the errors in understanding the law, I think some of those may be intentional. I think others are just folks not doing the best job. To Joe's point, what he's referring to is a case where an individual was charged with child abduction, and there was a question from the prosecutor on whether child abduction was detention eligible. It was. It seemed as if the prosecutor and the judge may have not known. Now, the funny thing about that story is that the person was detained anyway, actually. The person was detained on another case. The person was not released, even with the misunderstanding. We've got specific knowledge about that case, and that can, you know, the public can kind of do their own due diligence on looking that up. But the reality of the situation, that's kind of an example, right, of this system that we've built. I would argue that it is not the most kind to people who are accused of very serious offenses. If you look at the amount of people who are accused of offenses, especially in the domestic violence context, you know, you are looking at an uphill battle, unfortunately, when it comes to, and I say unfortunately because there's been no evidence, right, that you've been, you know, actually guilty of anything. But, you know, we are looking at, you know, a serious consideration about whether you should be held or not. Compare that to the status quo, to what happened before the Pretrial Fairness Act, where if you had enough money, you were going to get out no matter what, right? So there have certainly been benefits in terms of, I think, having really more elaborate discussions and detailed discussions about detention, and we're not just relying on money. With that said, there was a trailer bill. That is definitely the case. There are several trailer bills, actually, that modified the Pretrial Fairness Act, but I would argue that was actually part of the design, right? One of the reasons why you saw an intentional two-year runway was to actually ensure that there was more time to work out whatever changes need to be made, and you have to, I think, give credit to the sponsors of the bill that brought together both public defenders, prosecutors, the law enforcement community to make changes to the bill. I don't think that the structure of the bill was changed. There were some kind of changes to some of the standards, and I think that, you know, I'm not sure those standards were changed or significant, but certainly there was was a more elaborate standard or more expanded standard when it came to threats to public safety.
Joe Tabor of the Illinois Policy Center says there are some very clear challenges to carrying out the law, whether you agreed with its passage or not.
Kind of some of the issues that we've been seeing are issues of resources for prosecutors, for courts. We've seen the appeals courts swamped with, it seemed like they were not expecting the level of appeals that they would get from the from petitions to detain pretrial. So that seems to be something that was not planned for. In addition, downstate Illinois does not have the resources that, for example, Cook County does, and they're seeing a lot of pressure. In the prosecutor's offices, we're seeing is that they kind of have to triage, and they're putting in a lot of work, and they're under a lot of a pressure to get these petitions filed. Those are the kind of broad issues with the implementation of the bill. The other issues are with the public perception. Insha talked about how there was a campaign against the bill itself. And that's part of the reason that there's some misunderstandings about what the bill says, what is a detainable offense. For example, this is even in the case of prosecutors and judges. There was a case in Chicago the other day that where a prosecutor didn't know that attempted kidnapping was a detainable offense, and the judge didn't either. And so someone who might have been detained was released.
Moderator Raph Donaldson asked the panelists how, going forward, we should judge whether this bail reform is a success, and he got different answers and, interestingly enough, some general agreement. Insha Rahman started things off with a cautionary note.
I would say the most important thing we can do is not judge success or failure by individual high-profile cases. If it is making the front page of the news, it is not a good measure of how the law is doing overall. It is simply a reflection of one high profile, usually a tragedy, an awful incident, but that cannot be how we make policy or roll back policy or make changes. We've seen that done time and time again. So I'm in New York. We saw the 5-10 bad cases sort of dictate the debate in early 2020, and New York legislature rolled back some of bail reform in April of 2020. The new rollback law went into effect in July 2020. What happened with crime? It continued to go up because there were other factors that were not bail reform. There was a pandemic. There was an increase in crime all across the country, not just New York. It kept going up. Finally came down sometime around mid-2022, and it's continuing to go down.
Joe Tabor with the Illinois Policy Institute picked up on the general theme.
I agree that we should not be looking at individual cases, especially there's a lot of these cases where you'll see them sensationalized have more to do with things like prosecutorial discretion or than bail reform itself. It doesn't have anything to do with the cash, whether cash bail was available or not. And in many cases, as is pointed out, people who have the cash can pay it and then get out. And you've seen the same thing happen before the Pretrial Fairness Act was passed. I do think we should be looking at the data as it comes out, looking at the trends, just reporting on how things are going and looking to see where we could do better.
Public defender Sharon Mitchell had the last word on this issue.
I think Joe brings up a great point that there are different experiences. People talk about there are 102 counties. Some people would say that maybe there are 102 criminal legal systems. There are actually probably thousands and thousands. And one of the good things that Loyola's done is really look at different jurisdictions, not just Cook County, and evaluating a number of metrics. Additionally, here in Cook County, we know that the chief judge has been collecting data and has made that data available on a data dashboard on his website. And we do know that there are other institutions that have been looking at the issue, including the Civic Federation and the Chicago Appleseed, who've been looking at, you know, successes and failures.
I would like to thank Joe Tabor with the Illinois Policy Institute, Cook County Public Defender Sharon Mitchell, and Insha Rahman with the Vera Institute for Justice for participating in the civil disagreements discussion. And my thanks to the sponsors, the American Bar Association, the Chicago chapters of the American Constitution Society and the Federalist Society, and the group Reform for Illinois. I thank all of them for giving us permission to broadcast these excerpts. To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, WBBMNewsRadio.com. There's a link on the homepage, and you can also find our podcasts on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Dullimore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep, and when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience because Purple mattresses are made with a gel flex grid. The gel flex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips and support in others like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the gel flex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines Gel Flex Grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off. It's better
over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
If your day sounds like...
We need the report ASAP.
You deserve Modelo. If you've persevered through, you deserve this rich golden lager with a crisp but refreshing taste. Or if you overcame,
two more.
You deserve this ice cold reward. Modelo, the markable fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
After literally years of debate and discussion, last year, Illinois eliminated cash bail as a way of determining who stays behind bars while awaiting trial and who doesn't. Opponents of the move predicted dire and dangerous consequences. So how's it going? This weekend, you'll find out. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Dullimore, and this is At Issue. Recently, a stellar panel took stock of the Pretrial Fairness Act and how Illinois' legal system is handling its provisions. The online event was part of the Civil Disagreements series sponsored by the American Bar Association, the Chicago chapters of the American Constitution Society and the Federalist Society, and the group Reform for Illinois. The three-member panel and the moderator looked at how the law was created, how it is being applied, and what may need to be changed in the law or the legal system. This weekend, we'll hear some excerpts. But first, I want to offer words of praise for the moderator of the panel, Professor Raff Donaldson. You won't hear his voice, but the faculty member of the Chicago Kent College of Law expertly guided the discussion. The panel included Joe Tabor with the Illinois Policy Institute, Cook County Public Defender Sharon Mitchell, and Insha Rahman with the Vera Institute of Justice. Each panelist was allowed 5 minutes or so to give their assessment of the Pretrial Fairness Act. The first panelist didn't take that long, but he played a vital role in the discussion. Joe Tabor could be considered the most conservative member of the group.
First, I'd like to thank the American Bar Association, the American Constitution Society, the Federalist Society, and Reform for Illinois for hosting this discussion. And thank you to Tiffany for running the behind the scenes, to Raf for moderating, and to my co-panelists, Insha and Sharon, who have actual hands-on experience in this criminal justice space. My name is Joe Tabor, and I'm the Director of Policy for Director of Policy Research for the Illinois Policy Institute. We are primarily a free market think tank, but we also have done research in the realm of public safety and criminal justice reform. We've helped pass laws creating a path for people who have served time to obtain licenses as healthcare workers. And we are working on legislation to make it easier for those on electronic monitoring to find employment. As was said, in September, Illinois became the first state to completely eliminate cash bail statewide. And I think there are three things that we should keep in mind when we discuss that historic first. The first is that crime is a top priority for voters, especially in Chicago, and for good reason. 58% of people, of Chicagoans, put crime as their number one or number two concern. And violent crime spiked 11% in the past year. Theft, robbery, assault, battery are all up since then. Carjackings and vehicle thefts have doubled from the pre-pandemic levels. And a lot of people want to lay that partially at the feet of the bail reform, the getting rid of cash bail. And I think part of the reason for that is that the process of passing the legislation was lacked a lot of transparency, and it was rushed through. There were things that needed to be changed in the law, and it just seems that there's a fog of confusion around what the law actually says among the public. And number three is that these problems cannot be laid at the hands of bail reform. Bail reform is intended for a different purpose. It's not supposed to be used to detain dangerous criminals, even though that's what we had begun to rely upon on it. It's not a good way to do that. Cash bail tends to punish people who don't have money and release people who can pay the fee. But even so, the details matter, and there's things that we could have done better in this version of the law.
Sharon Mitchell spoke next.
My name is Sharon Mitchell, Jr. I work at the head of the Law Office of the Cook County Public Defender. The Law Office of the Cook County Public Defender represents the vast majority of people here in Cook County, which is Chicago and many of its suburbs. When somebody cannot afford an attorney on their own, they are appointed an attorney from our office. And because the vast majority of people in the criminal legal system are poor, that means, unfortunately, that we represent the vast majority of people. So that is kind of our engagement with the process. I had some pre-prepared remarks, but the spirit has hit me to tell a story. I've been at the public defender's office a couple of times. This is my second instance with the public defender's office. Between stays, I worked in policy, and I worked to help support some of the changes to the pretrial system. And during that time, I was kind of going to a lot of radio stations or news outlets and kind of talking about what these changes could potentially make. And shortly after the signing of the law in 2021, I think it was in March or April, I returned to a radio show. And it was one of these formats where they had one conservative and they had one liberal, and they would kind of debate on the issues, right? And as soon as I got on the show, one of the members basically said, "Well, Sharone, you came on here and talked about in the cash bond, and you finally got what you wanted. And look what happened. There's all this crime that has happened because of the in the cash bond." We were talking at that time in March or April of 2021. What the host did not know is that the actual changes would not be scheduled to happen for 2 years, right? So they were commenting on kind of the increase in crime supported by the end of cash bond about 18 months too soon. And the reality of the situation is that's what's happened a lot, right? There's this idea that that bond reform or bail reform is kind of this pro-criminal reform, and that there will be increases in crime just by its existence. And the actual facts and the realities don't really play into what is devolved into kind of a political discussion. I think Joe's right, though, that the details do matter. And the reality of the situation, if we take a step back, shortly before the passage of this bill, there was a well-funded and well-organized and really well-targeted campaign that tried to describe the changes around the Pretrial Fairness Act. It was described as the purge. It was described by really, unfortunately, serious people with serious jobs that the streets would run red with blood. Folks characterized the change as a deterioration of the criminal legal system. Well, we are now about 6 months into the actual implementation. About 8 months of the actual implementation. I just want to congratulate everybody on surviving the purge, right? The reality is that the changes in the Pretrial Fairness Act were common sense reforms. We can get deeper into what those reforms were, but the idea that we use money as a determining factor and whether somebody should be in jail pretrial or before any trial has happened was always a broken model. And whether you came from more of a law enforcement pro law and order space or a more reformist or abolitionist, or there are too many people in jail space, everybody agreed that the system that we had before made no sense. So I'm really glad that we have moved into a system where judges are making these decisions based upon risk and not money. With that said, the Pretrial Fairness Act did not produce any crystal balls, right? It did not for judges. It did not didn't abolish the presumption of innocence, right? So there are going to be people, right, who are accused of an offense and then reaccused of another offense, right? Those stories definitely exist. And we know that there are members or media forums that are dedicated to telling the story of every failure. But the reality is, right, the vast majority of people who are accused of a crime come back to court, right? Whether they are given a cash bond or not. And we know that oftentimes when we're discussing these issues, we rarely talk about the impacts on communities that the cash bond system presented. As a young public defender, one of the hardest things I ever had to do or to do constantly is talk with people from my community, mainly mothers, grandmothers, partners, sisters, women, about whether they would pay their loved one's bond or whether they would do the basic things they needed to do to survive, paying rent, things of that nature. The fact that we've eradicated this system, which served as a really one of the worst regressive taxes on Black and Brown women, is quite frankly one of the best reforms that we could have taken on. And as we continue to move forward, there are changes that could be made. There'll be debates forever, but the reality of the situation is the system before the Pretrial Fairness Act was incredibly broken, and we're seeing significant benefits both in terms of public safety and fairness. So I'm really excited to have this conversation. Thank you so much to Joe. Thank you so much to Insha. And thank you so much to all the great folks that have put this debate together. And one thing I can say before I conclude is that I'm so glad that we have an opportunity to talk about the details and talk about what's really happening in this reform and push back past the politics of this issue and really talk about what it means to keep our community safe and make sure that our people who are accused of offenses have their constitutional rights looked after. So thank you so much, and looking forward to the conversation.
Finally, we heard from the Vera Institute's Insha Rahman.
Thank you for the grace of getting to go last, so I get to listen to these brilliant folks and build upon their thoughts. So I got my start in working on this issue as a young public defender as well. And as Sharon said, it is both devastating to have the conversation with a mother or a sister or a girlfriend or a wife, like, how am I gonna pay my rent? Or do I pay bail, knowing that not paying bail is the biggest consequence for the end of that case and also for that person's life. And then there's the other piece of it, which take out the sort of personal human impact, which is incredibly important, and go to the system itself. Every time I watched a judge set $250 bail or $500 bail, I always ask myself this question of, is the judge intending for this person to get out because they think that they can make $250 or $500? As a public defender in the Bronx, it's one of the poorest counties in the country. People don't have $25, let alone $250 or $500. Or does the judge intend to keep my client in jail, in which case there should be far more due process than just setting a money bail amount before we take away somebody's liberty? So the problem with cash bail is, from perspective of the system, is that it obscures the real decision about whether somebody should rightfully be out or be in pending trial. So I did that work for a long time and then came to the Vera Institute of Justice, which is where I am now, in 2015. And I'm based in our New York office, and I work nationally on issues of bail reform. I'm the vice president of advocacy and partnerships at the organization and have worked on bail for the better part of a decade doing policy work. And I worked on New York bail reform. And it doesn't matter where you are in this country, if you've never stepped foot in New York, you have an opinion about New York bail reform because you've heard things. And chances are what you heard is not flattering. And let me tell you this, 4 years after New York bail reform has gone into effect, as a matter of policy, it's working. It's doing exactly what bail reform is intended to do, which is to take money out of the equation, especially for low-level offenses where people should just be going home. There's no actual threat to public safety. And it's making sure that when bail is in fact set, because New York bail reform retained bail, it didn't really change the system for the more serious cases, the cases in which there are concerns about public safety, according to the allegations. What it did require judges to do is really consider ability to pay, and therefore that obscured decision of, like, is that money intended to keep the person in or allow them to be released? We actually get to look at that decision honestly. So it's not a perfect bail reform, in my opinion, as somebody who worked on it, but it is a bail reform that is working and that public safety has not been affected in New York. There are multiple credible studies from multiple different universities and researchers who have looked at the rise in crime in New York in 2021, 2022, it's coming back down, 2023 and into 2024, that rise in crime was not due to bail reform. They both happened to happen at the same time, but they are not correlated, let alone have any causation effect. And the other thing that we've seen is that bail reform has been good for justice, in that there are far fewer people behind bars in New York today as a result of that reform. And the reason I start with talking about New York bail reform is because it was, I would say, the first to go and sort of experience the real political backlash that we know Illinois experienced after in 2022 during the midterm election cycle, the purge. I can put a hard number on it, which was in Illinois. Before the law had ever gone into effect, the opposition spent $40 million fear-mongering about the law. And yet what happened in Illinois that I think is remarkable as a matter of politics that didn't happen in New York, because the minute the backlash to New York bail reform started in 2020, the same legislators who enacted the law, who passed it, who celebrated it a year before, ran for the hills and said, uh-oh, actually, we didn't mean to go that far. And they actually rolled back parts of the law literally within 4 months of it going into effect. And then we've been in rollback after rollback for 4 years. This is the first legislative session where there are no rollbacks to bail reform, so it is possible to get out of the bad politics, but you got to stay in there. It takes 4 to 5 years is what we're learning. In Illinois in 2022, when the political backlash started, we watched all those same legislators, everybody from Governor Pritzker on down to state legislators, actually hold firm. Maybe there were conversations behind closed doors, which were, uh-oh, what did we do? But publicly, it was support for the Pretrial Fairness Act and a reminder of why money bail is not just, it is not fair, and it is not a good system. And Pretrial Fairness Act went into effect in 2023, as we know, but at the end of 2022, during the midterm cycle, there was actually a poll that came out in late November, which asked Illinois voters, when it comes to bail reform, are you favorable, neutral, or unfavorable towards the law? 60% of Illinois voters said, even after $40 million worth of fear-mongering about the law, that we remain neutral or favorable towards the law. And it's because the politics held up around the law, supported the reforms, reminded people why we needed reform in the first place. And it's a really important lesson, I think, coming out of Illinois. And I know that we're a bunch of lawyers on this call, but I think we can't think only about policy or implementation or practice. We have to think about politics. We live in a world where politics is a very real thing. It's really important to think about the politics of these reforms and of implementation. And Illinois, from where I sit, is a great example of getting it right. I know there's a lot more work to be done. We're going to get into the details here. But I think that national perspective, and especially putting it in contrast with another law that has actually done what it's supposed to do, but doesn't feel that way, I think it's really important for Illinois to have started off on the right foot as a matter of politics. And from what I can see, is continuing to actually hold the politics around the law, even as it goes into implementation. It will not be perfect, but we can see positive momentum, public support remains, and that is, I think, a really good thing for not only Illinois, but for other states to look to.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Delamore, and we're hearing excerpts from a symposium on how Illinois' justice system is faring now that cash bail has essentially been eliminated. The event was put on by the American Bar Association, the Chicago chapters of the American Constitution Society and the Federalist Society, and the group Reform for Illinois. As you heard, all of the panelists agree it's a positive step to move away from letting the ability to pay be what determines whether a person stays behind bars while awaiting trial or not. But they were asked about the challenges the law presents. Insha Rahman went first.
Where we've seen bail reform statewide work is where there's been significant investment and building up of community-based pretrial services. And that has started to happen in some parts of Illinois, but it is pretty checkered, and there hasn't been, I would say, nearly enough money, nearly enough investment, and nearly enough sort of standardization of how pretrial services happens, so that judges actually have a choice in the cases where they have discretion about, do I release this person or do I detain them pending trial? Do I have another option? And I would say in the law itself, there are some good safeguards around when supervision can be imposed and when it shouldn't be, some safeguards around sort of not having permanent or endless supervision during the pretrial period. But in order for any of that to be a reality and to take hold, you've got to do pretrial services well.
Sharon Mitchell, the public defender, felt a little background was in order here.
This law was signed into place in January of 2021. There were about 2 years and 8 months between the time that it was signed into law and the time it actually went into effect. So, you know, some of the errors in understanding the law, I think some of those may be intentional. I think others are just folks not doing the best job. To Joe's point, what he's referring to is a case where an individual was charged with child abduction, and there was a question from the prosecutor on whether child abduction was detention eligible. It was. It seemed as if the prosecutor and the judge may have not known. Now, the funny thing about that story is that the person was detained anyway, actually. The person was detained on another case. The person was not released, even with the misunderstanding. We've got specific knowledge about that case, and that can, you know, the public can kind of do their own due diligence on looking that up. But the reality of the situation, that's kind of an example, right, of this system that we've built. I would argue that it is not the most kind to people who are accused of very serious offenses. If you look at the amount of people who are accused of offenses, especially in the domestic violence context, you are looking at an uphill battle, unfortunately, when it comes to, and I say unfortunately because there's been no evidence, right, that you've been, you know, actually guilty of anything. But, you know, we are looking at, a serious consideration about whether you should be held or not. Compare that to the status quo, to what happened before the Pretrial Fairness Act, where if you had enough money, you were going to get out no matter what, right? So there have certainly been benefits in terms of, I think, having really more elaborate discussions and detailed discussions about detention, and we're not just relying on money. With that said, there was a trailer bill. That is definitely the case. There are several trailer bills, actually, that modified the Pretrial Fairness Act, but I would argue that was actually part of the design, right? One of the reasons why you saw an intentional two-year runway was to actually ensure that there was more time to work out whatever changes need to be made, and you have to, I think, give credit to the sponsors of the bill that brought together both public defenders, prosecutors, the law enforcement community to make changes to the bill. I don't think that the structure of the bill was changed. There were some kind of changes to some of the standards, and I think that, you know, I'm not sure those standards were changed were significant, but certainly there was a more elaborate standard, a more expanded standard when it came to threats to public safety.
Joe Tabor of the Illinois Policy Center says there are some very clear challenges to carrying out the law, whether you agreed with its passage or not.
Kind of some of the issues that we've been seeing are issues of resources for prosecutors, for courts. We've seen the appeals courts swamped with it seemed like they were not expecting the level of appeals that they would get from the from petitions to detain pretrial. So that seems to be something that was not planned for. In addition, downstate Illinois does not have the resources that, for example, Cook County does, and they're seeing a lot of pressure. In the prosecutor's offices, we're seeing is that they kind of have to triage, and they're putting in a lot of work, and they're under a lot of a pressure to get these petitions filed. Those are the kind of broad issues with the implementation of the bill. The other issues are with the public perception. Insha talked about how there was a campaign against the bill itself. And that's part of the reason that there's some misunderstandings about what the bill says, what is a detainable offense. For example, this is even in the case of prosecutors and judges. There was a case in Chicago the other day that where a prosecutor didn't know that attempted kidnapping was a detainable offense, and the judge didn't either. And so someone who might have been detained was released.
Moderator Raph Donaldson asked the panelists how, going forward, we should judge whether this bail reform is a success, and he got different answers and, interestingly enough, some general agreement. Insha Rahman started things off with a cautionary note.
I would say the most important thing we can do is not judge success or failure by individual high-profile cases. If it is making the front page of the news, it is not a good measure of how the law is doing overall. It is simply a reflection of one high profile, usually a tragedy, an awful incident, but that cannot be how we make policy or roll back policy or make changes. We've seen that done time and time again. So I'm in New York. We saw the 5-10 bad cases sort of dictate the debate in early 2020, and New York legislature rolled back some of bail reform in April of 2020. The new rollback law went into effect in July 2020. What happened with crime? It continued to go up because there were other factors that were not bail reform. There was a pandemic. There was an increase in crime all across the country, not just New York. It kept going up. Finally came down sometime around mid-2022, and it's continuing to go down.
Joe Tabor with the Illinois Policy Institute picked up on the general theme.
Well, I agree that we should not be looking at individual cases, especially there's a lot of these cases where you'll see them sensationalized have more to do with things like prosecutorial discretion or than bail reform itself. It doesn't have anything to do with the cash, whether cash bail was available or not. And in many cases, as is pointed out, people who have the cash can pay it and then get out. And you've seen the same thing happen before the Pretrial Fairness Act was passed. I do think we should be looking at the data as it comes out, looking at the trends, just reporting on how things are going, and looking to see where we could do better.
Public Defender Sharon Mitchell had the last word on this issue.
I think Joe brings up a great point that there are different experiences. People talk about there are 102 counties. Some people would say that maybe there are 102 criminal legal systems. There are actually probably thousands and thousands. And one of the good things that Loyola's done is really look at different jurisdictions, not just Cook County, and evaluating a number of metrics. Additionally, here in Cook County, we know that the chief judge has been collecting data and has made that data available on a data dashboard on his website. And we do know that there are other institutions that have been looking at the issue, including the Civic Federation and the Chicago Appleseed, who've been looking at, you know, successes and failures.
I would like to thank Joe Tabor with the Illinois Policy Institute, Cook County Public Defender Sharon Mitchell, and Insha Rahman with the Vera Institute for Justice for participating in the civil disagreements discussion. And my thanks to the sponsors, the American Bar Association, the Chicago chapters of the American Constitution Society and the Federalist Society, and the group Reform for Illinois. I thank all of them for giving us permission to broadcast these excerpts. To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, WBBMNewsRadio.com. There's a link on the homepage, and you can also find our podcasts on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Dullimore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Payoff up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
Postseason baseball is here, and it is the absolute best time of the year. I'm Rob Bradford of Baseballs and Boring, and we're going to have you covered every step of the way with instant reactions from players and coaches and managers and fans and reporters and everybody else who is immersed in this awesomeness and all the craziness that comes with October baseball. So follow Baseballs and Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.